Engaging with information keeps our consciousness stuck in formation, in the forms of all those words and sounds and pictures. Like molten plastic that's poured into molds and left to cool into objects that are now stuck in those shapes. When we get used to that, even though it's cramped and confining, we forget how to live without it. Then, when we're denied access to our screens and our consciousness starts relaxing in the direction of unformed freedom again, we feel uneasy. Without our familiar constrictive boundaries, we can feel like we're going into some kind of free fall. And we are, with the emphasis on the word free. Our natural meditation approach is to use everything in our lives as alarm clocks, to wake ourselves up out of all our addictions and afflictions, into a life of rich experience for ourselves and sensitive responsiveness to others. That especially includes, using the things that seem like obstacles to awakening. So, in the case of the handy pocket-sized Apple or Android Distract-O-Matic, how can we flip this addiction around and turn it into a meditative practice? Actually, it's simple. The next time you're in one of those involuntary nothing-happening moments, your date goes off to the bathroom, you're stuck at a red light, you're waiting for an elevator, and you find yourself automatically reaching for your phone, just don't do it. Yes, I understand how unhelpful that sounds, but hang on, here comes the subtle, skillful part. When you refrain from grabbing your phone, you're going to feel a wave of squirmy anxiety. If there were an app that translated vague feelings into words, and there probably will be soon, it would read out as something like, but I might be missing something, maybe something important, or interesting, or fun, or something. Feed me some news, stimulate me with input, give me anything, as long as I don't have to sit here and deal with nothing, because that's unbearable. Feeling that wave of anxiety is fine. In fact, it's what's going to make this meditation work. The key is to let the wave happen. Don't try to ignore the feeling. Don't try to suppress it. Don't try to turn it into something else. Instead, experience what that feeling actually is, a set of subtle, internal, physical sensations, maybe in the chest, or abdomen, or head. Allow yourself to feel that feeling as it changes and moves and finally passes through you in its own time, like a wave passing through the ocean. Just don't ride the wave. Don't be caught up in it, driven by it, compelled by it to do something, like whip out your phone. Then, a small miracle happens. The wave does indeed pass, and you're still here. You didn't follow the compulsion, and your head didn't explode after all. This is called freedom, and this little taste of freedom has exactly the same flavor as the big freedom of nirvana. We discover that the nothing we've been trying so hard to avoid is delicious nothing. You can use the same approach with other kinds of compulsions. When you find yourself getting caught up in the urge to light a cigarette or make a cutting remark that's going to hurt someone, just don't do it. Or at least hold off and don't do it right away. Give yourself time to feel that wave of fidgety anxiety. Notice what it feels like in the body, let it be there for as long as it needs to, and then let it pass. Don't try to push it away, but don't buy into it. Maybe 5 minutes later you'll light the cigarette anyway, but if you buy yourself 5 minutes of freedom, you've accomplished something. If you keep practicing like this, with the cigarettes or the phone or whatever else has been pushing you around, the little patches of freedom will start to connect up. More and more, you'll find yourself living in liberative, wide-open space. You'll start to see how that delicious nothing underlies all moments, even when you're busy with lots of somethings. We can call this meditating with the iPhone Zero. Unlike other iPhones, it doesn't eventually grow stale as we seek our next source of distraction. Liberation never goes out of style. What's now your spiffiest gizmo will one day seem as primitive as a lump of coal in your pocket. But the iPhone Zero is timeless. It will be just as fresh when space colonists use it on the planets of distant galaxies as it was when the ancient yogis used it in the jungles of India. Enjoy your freedom. Chapter 24. You Should Be Dancing. I hated high school dances. I didn't know the cool moves. I felt awkward and stupid and spotlight conspicuous in my body. It was my old playground nightmare, now multiplied by surging hormones and hopeless romantic yearnings. I envied the guys with older sisters who would play records or watch American Bandstand and make them dance with them. Those guys always looked so slick and confident out on the floor, while I lurked on the sidelines, trying to figure out how they did it. Figure out. That, of course, was the problem. I was trying to process it through my thinking mind. When I did work up the courage to get out on the floor with a whoop girl, I spent the whole time listening to my mind, trying to break down what the other kids were doing, explain to my body how to imitate them, evaluate how I was measuring up, and monitor the exact amount of amused scorn with which the girl and every other kid in the gym was surely watching my dorky moves. I was miserable. A few years later, I discovered how to break out of my misery. Weed. By then, I was going to college in San Francisco, and some up-and-coming local bands with names like, oh, The Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, and Big Brother and the Holding Company kept showing up at the auditoriums and parks with their pulsing, flowing new sounds. Suddenly it was fine to dance without a partner. With no girl to impress, I could lose myself in the sea of friendly, groovy strangers. Dancing high, dancing with my eyes closed, dancing with myself, I had a big epiphany. Forget how it looks from the outside, just feel it from the inside. Listen to the music, not the thoughts. And listen with the whole body. I could let the music bypass my mind and go straight to my belly, my spine, my pelvis, my arms and legs. The music moved them, and I just went along for the ride. There was one disappointment at first. I thought marijuana was supposed to blow my mind, to bomb that ever-churning thought factory into incapacity. But the thoughts were still there, often, in fact, amplified, as if ricocheting through some kind of funhouse echo chamber. Then, however, the disappointment gave way to another discovery. I could ignore the thoughts. I was too busy listening to the music and being moved by it to worry about thoughts. Screw 'em. Within a few years, my earnest pot-smoking phase came to an end, having served its purpose. I learned to meditate and quickly discovered that it worked basically the same way as dancing high. You close your eyes, you relax, you ignore your thoughts, you let what happens happen. The option of ignoring thoughts, it turned out, was always available, even without herbal assistance. I realized that most thoughts, both in and out of meditation, were just static, and rather than try to grapple with them or silence them, I could let them sizzle harmlessly in the background, like a skillet of onions frying back in the kitchen, while I relaxed at the table, enjoying my pie. I still love to dance, whether it's late at night in my living room with the lights off, or on a crowded floor while some cornball bar mitzvah band murders We Are Family. I don't need weed or the dead or the hippies in Golden Gate Park. I can dance, I can jive, having the time of my life. As far as I know, my moves may still look dorky to anyone watching. But You know that Facebook cliche, dance like nobody's watching? Well, nobody's watching. It turns out that no one cares what your moves look like. And if they did, so what? Who cares if they care? That's all just more thoughts. If anything, my dorky moves give other people permission to relax and stop worrying about their moves. My ungracefulness helps confer a state of grace. You're welcome. Dancing like this, closing your eyes, giving up to the music, feeling the moves from the inside rather than watching them from the outside, disempowering your thoughts and fears by simply ignoring them, is meditation, as surely as sitting on a cushion is. As it happens, research has shown that dancing has some of the same benefits as sitting meditation, including reduced stress, anxiety, insomnia and depression, enhanced cognitive abilities, and crucially, enhanced neuroplasticity, the body's ability to keep renewing and rewiring neural pathways, even into old age. That's consistent with the results of a 21-year study of subjects over age 75, led by the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. It found that swimming, bicycling, and golf gave no protection from dementia due to Alzheimer's and other causes. Reading or doing crossword puzzles gave some mild protection, but frequent dancing reduced the risk by 76%. Of all these findings, the one I've seen demonstrated most dramatically in real life, again and again, is that of breaking through depression. If you're depressed, dancing may be the last thing you want to do, but it's the first thing you have to do. In traditional cultures, no one needed scientists to tell them this. Gabrielle Roth, the great pioneer of healing and opening through dance, wrote, "In many shamanic societies, if you came to a medicine person complaining of being disheartened, dispirited, or depressed, they would ask one of four questions. When did you stop dancing? When did you stop singing? When did you stop being enchanted by stories? When did you stop finding comfort in the sweet territory of silence?" The sweet territory of silence is what we, less poetically, call meditation. But singing, dancing, and storytelling, my profession, belong right alongside it. They're all ways of living boldly, of dancing through life like nobody's watching. Dancing is a door to liberation. Eventually, we discover that everything is. "Some dance to remember, some dance to forget," says a song we've all heard too many times. Here we're doing both, dancing to remember what we are, which is free, and to forget all the old stories that tell us we aren't. Dare to be silly. I used to teach an acting and public speaking course at a top-drawer prep school in New Jersey. Most of the students tightened up at the prospect of being on stage and possibly looking foolish. The solution was to get that out of the way, look very foolish and have fun doing it. I showed them Monty Python's great Ministry of Silly Walks routine, available online, and then we had our own Silly Walks contest. That got everyone nice and loose. It's recommended. It's also recommended as a way to deflate your ability to maintain rage or to take yourself too seriously, two things that often go hand in hand. In fact, my personal plan for world peace starts with a huge, festive, internationally televised Silly Walks Olympics. Let's put the Israelis and the Palestinians in the first round. You can use dance in a similar way. Fears of looking foolish, of being vulnerable, of being hurt, tend to make us frozen in both our range of motion and our range of emotion. To help bust out of those inhibitions and the patterns of physical rigidity that sustain them, you can, in the privacy of your own home, with the shades drawn, run your own Ministry of Silly Dances. Just play. You can start subtle and inflate from there. doing big, exaggerated, clown-like dances, portraying big, exaggerated, clown-like emotions. Be the world's worst mime. Of course, you need the right music to egg you on. You can build your own playlist so you can access different moods as needed, but here are a few suggestions to get you started. Joyous. Toon Yards, Water Fountain. Pharrell Williams, Happy. Stevie Wonder, Isn't She Lovely? Beatles, Twist and Shout. Bob Marley, One Love. Louis Armstrong, What a Wonderful World. Maria Muldaur, You Ain't Going Nowhere. Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Katrina and the Waves, Walking on Sunshine. Melancholy. Tori Amos, Crucify, Silent All These Years. David Darling, Darkwood. Patsy Cline, I Fall to Pieces, Crazy. Chris Isaak, Can't Do a Thing to Stop Me, Wicked Game. Roy Orbison, Crying. John Coltrane, Soul Eyes. Yo-Yo Ma, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Silk Road. Rolling Stones, Angie, Wild Horses. Jeff Buckley, Hallelujah. Beck, Lost Cause. Graham Parsons, Love Hurts. UB40, Red Red Wine. Sexy. Prince, Kiss. Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On. Donna Summer, Love to Love You, Baby. Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy. Barry White, I'm Gonna Love You Just a Little Bit More, Baby. Rick James, Give It to Me. Tony Braxton, Art of Love. Isley Brothers, Between the Sheets. Triumphant, Tchaikovsky, 1812 Overture Finale. Vangelis, Chariots of Fire Theme. Furious, Public Image Limited, Public Image. David Bowie, Rebel Rebel. Queen, Stone Cold Crazy. Patti Smith, Rock and Roll Nigger. Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, Lithium. Sex Pistols, Anarchy in the UK. Verdi, Dies Irae. Tranquil. Arvo Pärt, Spiegel im Spiegel. Deuter, Nada Himalaya. Moby, Novio. Tense, David Bowie, Fashion, Heroes, Station to Station. Rolling Stones, Gimme Shelter. Led Zeppelin, Kashmir, When the Levee Breaks, Immigrant Song. Menacing, Velvet Underground, Venus in Furs. Loving, Elvis Presley, Love Me Tender. Stevie Wonder, As. Beatles, And I Love Her, In My Life. Chaka Khan, Ain't Nobody. Turtles, Happy Together. Ry Cooder, Maria Elena. Jefferson Airplane, Today. Jackie Wilson, Your Love Keeps Lifting Me Higher. MC Yogi, Only Love Is Real. Expansive, Beth Orton, Don't Wanna Know About Evil. Coldplay, Clocks. Moby, Ever Loving. Samuel Barber, Agnus Dei. Beatles, Here Comes the Sun. Jefferson Airplane, Embryonic Journey, DCBA 25. Beck, Wow. Bjork, Thunderbolt. Birds, 8 Miles High. George Harrison, Marwa Blues. My own favorite moods are loving and expansive, and for that, my one indispensable Desert Island album is Music for Yoga and Other Joys by Jai Uttal and Ben Lineback. As you find your own unrestrained, unstructured solo dancing spirit, it can be extra fun to bring that spirit to dancing with a partner. This requires you to be awake in the moment, to respond sensitively to your partner, and become fluent in nonverbal communication. That dementia study found that the maximum protection comes from social dancing. If you're married or in a relationship and you really want it to work, my top 3 recommendations are to sit in meditation every day, walk together as often as possible, and dance together at least, say, once a week. Every relationship tends to develop unresolved, weirdo energy pockets, places in your interactions where unexpressed anger, resentment, or misunderstanding accumulate and fester. Sometimes talking about these pockets is helpful, but sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it even makes them worse. Time to twist and shout, work it on out. Nietzsche was probably thinking of the familiar Judeo-Christian image of God as a burly king planted on his heavy throne when he wrote, "I would believe only in a God who could dance." In India, they have lots of gods who both dance and sit. The outstanding example is Shiva, who is the lord of meditators, sitting immovably on his tiger skin high in the snowy Himalayas, as well as the lord of dance, with crazy swinging dreadlocks, ecstatically rocking and rolling the universe through its cycles of creation and dissolution. These two seeming opposites, stern, steadfast meditator and dancing fool, are understood to be one, and Shiva, like all the gods, is understood to represent the unfolding of your own deepest self. Hindus chant, "Shivoham, Shivoham, I am Shiva, I am Shiva." If you sit and steep in enough inner silence, or if you dance with enough rapture, you dissolve the dream that you're a finite little organism and wake up as the infinite. Chapter 25. Who Needs Sleep? Insomnia sucks. If you've had it, you know all about the frustrating hours spent wide awake. You also know about the tantalizing minutes in the hypnagogic state, a.k.a. pre-sleep limbo. This is the transitional falling phase that most people pass through briefly on their way to asleep, but which insomniacs may repeatedly dip in and out of, achingly close to the garden of sweet oblivion, only to be pushed out the garden gate again and again. For what it's worth, if fear, worry, anger, substance withdrawal, or any other agitated state has been roiling your sleep, at least know that you have it better than some people. Men I've worked with in prison, fearing to drop their vigilance long enough to be assaulted, never allow themselves to fall completely into a deep sleep, and never sleep on their stomachs. Still, insomnia, whether occasional or chronic, is a drag. Because you're agitated, you can't sleep. Because you can't sleep, you get more agitated, and round and round you go. Fortunately, the meditative toolbox contains some methods that can help you break out of this cycle. As it happens, I got my genes from two parents who were both lousy sleepers. So this is another area where I've had a strong personal stake in thoroughly testing the tools. Once again, my bad luck is your good luck. If you've been practicing our core method of sitting in natural meditation with some regularity, your sleep may have already improved. By spending even a few minutes a day settled in a mellow, low-adrenaline state of parasympathetic activation, you're teaching your body how good that feels. Your body learns the way there, so that any time it's given a chance, like being tucked into a comfy bed, it will tend to return on its own. There are also specialized nighttime methods for helping the process along, but first let's attend to some practical matters. If you suspect that some kind of medical problem is involved, of course consult your healthcare provider. Fortunately, more doctors these days are getting tuned into non-medicinal, no-side-effects therapies. They may suggest anything from a glass of warm milk at bedtime to a stiff dose of melatonin or Hanokiol. If the underlying problem is sleep apnea, they may even recommend playing the didgeridoo. Studies have shown its therapeutic effectiveness in restoring proper breathing. Most experts warn against reading in bed to avoid its stimulating effect. But these things are not one size fits all. Some people find that reading in bed can knock them out real nice if they get it tuned just right. For example, by using dim light and reading material that's just engaging enough to distract them from compulsive thought patterns, but just boring enough to gently bludgeon them into oblivion. I've had a lot of luck with certain books of the Old Testament. Thank you, Gideons, for all those hotel room Bibles. Electronic screens of all kinds are considered a no-no as well, but if your reading light keeps your bed partner awake, you may have to resort to reading from your phone or tablet. These days, there's a helpful feature called Night Shift, which changes the screen's display from the stimulating blue end of the light spectrum to the more sedating red end. Or you can switch off the screen and listen to an audiobook, preferably a nice, boring one, narrated in a droning monotone. LibriVox.org offers a lot of free downloadable audiobooks, many of them obscure texts of ancient history, all read by amateur narrators with, let's just say, varying levels of skill. Attitude adjustment. Once, when I was on a 5-month-long retreat with Maharishi in Mallorca, a retreatant complained, "I can't sleep because I'm afraid of ghosts." Maharishi replied, "No, you're afraid of ghosts because you can't sleep." That's a potent insight. Your obsessive thoughts, whether they're about ghosts or politics or your love life or your finances, may be a byproduct of your insomnia, not the cause. Then the root cause is neurological, energetic. Some congestion or overstimulation of energy interrupts our sleep, which in turn provokes thoughts. That's why two people with, say, the same financial problem, or the same person with the same financial problem on two different nights, might not suffer the same insomnia. This means you won't fix your insomnia by thinking your way through the problem of the moment. So you may as well give up trying. Just as you do when you sit to meditate, you can invoke the power of later. Decide that you're not going to decide anything in bed. You're not going to solve the world's problems or your own while the sun is down. You've probably had the experience of tossing and turning while seeking solutions, and either coming up empty or coming up with something that seemed brilliant at 3 a.m., but not so much in the morning light. So just assume up front that all your bedtime thoughts are nothing but chatter, and, just as in meditation, don't try to halt the thought train, but don't hop aboard either. There's a second attitudinal intervention that you can evoke that's even more surprising. It doesn't matter whether you sleep. It turns out that what we need is not sleep per se. It's the deep peace of inner silence that refreshes and rejuvenates us, what Macbeth calls the balm of hurt minds. For most people, the only place where they encounter such peace is in sleep. But as meditators, we're learning, with growing clarity, that we can access the peace of our own being in any situation. For those whose clarity approaches 100%, sleep may even become optional. At a Tibetan Buddhist ashram where I once spent some time, a renowned lama came to teach. In anticipation of his arrival, a beautiful bedroom was prepared, decorated with Tibetan religious art, and furnished with an extra comfy bed, topped by a soft bedspread once used by the Dalai Lama. But all the effort went for naught. It turned out that this Lama never used a bed. He just sat in the meditation hall for a little while each night, and then went about his business. Even for those of us who still use beds, just knowing that it doesn't absolutely matter whether or not we sleep can be profoundly liberating. We can relax through the night with one meditative method or another and know we'll feel rested in the morning. Ironically, once we let go of worrying about sleeping and get out of that vicious circle, there's a good chance we'll fall asleep. Here are some methods that can help you either sleep or be fine with not sleeping. First, three old friends, and then some new ones. Rest as awareness. Our core method of effortless resting as awareness makes a perfect nighttime meditation for many people, but not all. As you've experienced, meditation produces a state of restful alertness. For most people, the restful aspect will predominate enough so that, if you do it at night when you're fatigued, you'll fall asleep. For a few people, the alertness will dominate and prevent sleep. That's fine if you feel ready to go the way of the llama and not bother with sleep, but otherwise one of the following methods will be a better choice. Feet first. Another old friend, breathing through your feet, is always good. As you've probably found, this method is especially helpful when you feel that your head is buzzing with thoughts. If that's the situation at bedtime, you can just get horizontal, breathe at a natural rhythm while imagine feeling that you're breathing through your feet, and let things settle in their own time. If you find yourself repeatedly, almost but not quite falling asleep, just stay with or keep gently returning to this method, cruising feet first through pre-sleep limbo for as long as necessary. Drop your thoughts. By now you know how to drop your thoughts, not trying to block or suppress them, just loosening your grip, letting go of your engagement with them, and relaxing back into your silent self. As usual, 5 seconds or so at a time is plenty. When you feel enveloped by obsessive nighttime thinking, repeatedly punching 5-second holes in it will weaken its power. You can also use this method in combination with others, such as left breath. When your mental energetic engine is running hot, a simple way to cool it down and welcome sleep, passed on by yogic lore, is to breathe through the left nostril. Simply hold your right thumb against the right side of your nose so it closes your right nostril, and breathe normally. Or also use the Ujjayi constriction as described in Chapter 9. The variation in which the out-breath takes 1.5 to 2 times as long as the in-breath may be particularly helpful. In a slightly more elaborate version, after each in-breath, you open the right nostril by releasing the thumb. Simultaneously, close the left nostril with the 3rd and 4th fingers, then breathe out through the right nostril. Continue switching back and forth, breathing in through the left and out through the right. In yogic terms, you're filling the body with the cooling, sedating left breath stream and emptying out the heating, arousing right breath stream. Which picture? The hypnagogic state of pre-sleep limbo is often a very visual landscape. As we sink below the level of the verbal and conceptual content that dominates our minds during the day, it's replaced by random images and short cartoony sequences that pop up but then dissolve, kicking us back up to the waking thinking level. If we can just stay with the visuals, we can ride them into sleep. So, this method generally works best if you're already a little drowsy. As you lie there, very quietly float the question, which picture are we on? The is important. It has to be done delicately. You can't make it happen, but given a chance, the visuals will take over on their own. Anytime you find yourself back in the verbal conceptual, float the question again. Which picture are we on? And once again the visuals will come to the foreground, while the words and thoughts fade to the background. Another version is to supply your own picture. Visualize something that for you evokes silence or peace. Say a mountain, or a tropical lagoon. Every time you realize you've gone off onto other thoughts, come back to this image. Here's a trippy one. Picture yourself, just as you are, lying in the bed, but fast asleep, totally out. At some point, the sleeping you in the picture and the you that's picturing it merge. Deep fifths. Recall our practice of singing descending fifths discussed in chapter 21. For this bedtime version, we sing that same downward slide, but mentally. Just hear it in your mind's ear. The dark vowel sounds, such as O or oo, as in flow or blue, are more sleep-friendly than the brighter sounds like E. And now, because you're not using your voice, you're not subject to its limitations, so you can extend the low note indefinitely. Mentally keep hearing it, way beyond the point where you would run out of breath, going steadily on and on without break. And again, because we're only singing mentally, you can go as low as you like, octaves below your actual vocal range. Thought bubbles. When you feel overwhelmed by the thoughts crowding your attention, you can imagine that each one is inside a comic strip thought bubble. Don't try to get rid of the thought. Just put a fun thought bubble around it. If a dozen thoughts are crowding around, vying for your attention, fine. Visualize them inside a dozen thought bubbles. Don't try to be specific about what the thoughts are or keep track of which one has gone where. Perhaps the thoughts are about work problems or political arguments or sexual fantasies, but whatever they are, now they're all tucked into fun thought bubbles, merrily bobbing and softly colliding in the air around you. Then, in the middle of all the other bubbles, visualize one that's empty, a bubble full of silence. Let it hang around over your head for a while. Then, if you're still awake, climb into it, lie back, and float, weightless. As you float along, let this silent, empty bubble slowly expand, gradually absorbing and neutralizing all the others, dissolving them into itself like the blob, growing bigger and bigger as it happily feeds on their energy. Yum, yum, eat 'em up. Then let it absorb you too. Finally, let it melt into space, the silent space of awareness, and rest in that. The ancient sages, by the way, clearly did not practice this method, but I like to think that they would have had there been comic strips in their time. It's fun to imagine what their favorite strips might have been. I think the Buddha could have been a serious fan of Peanuts, with its poignant representation of human suffering and futility. The kite that always gets stuck in the tree, the baseball team that always loses, the football that Lucy always snatches away. I can see the Buddha smiling gently, shaking his head, and murmuring, "You're a good man, Charlie Brown." Socrates, the probing gadfly of Athens, would probably be a Garfield man, just because, like Socrates, Garfield is annoying. Space gazing. Lie down, get comfortable, close your eyes, give things a few minutes to settle, and then gaze into space. Yes, it's dark, and yes, your eyes are closed, but that doesn't matter. There's still some sense of space in front of you. Gaze into that space, like gazing out a window into the night sky. As usual, there's no effort in this. Don't try to visualize anything clearly, and don't stare, just gaze. As soon as you think of it, it's already happening by itself. As you gaze, the experience may change. At times, the space may seem dark, or light, or dark speckled with light, or indefinable. It may seem flat at first, but then grow deeper, three-dimensional. After a while, as you continue to gaze, the space may seem to have endless depth. Sometimes it might even seem like you're zooming into Han Solo's hyperspace. In any case, it's always perfect just as it is, however it is. If your mind is very active with complex thoughts or emotional turmoil, it may at first resist this gazing into space and keep careening off in other directions. But be gently persistent, coming back again and again to this sense of space, till your attention locks into it. If you're still awake after a while, notice that, since you're not gazing with your physical eyes, you're not limited to their narrow scope. So now widen your scope so that you're gazing into space in all directions through your whole head. And now notice that you can widen your scope even further so that you're gazing out through your whole body, 360 degrees. After a while, let your body dissolve into that space so that nothing remains but space. Rest in this space, as this space. Occasionally, you may notice what feel like areas of energetic congestion or overstimulation here or there, a disturbance in the force, trying to pull you back into the body. Just allow these areas to dissolve and dissipate into the space. With practice, you may find that you can skip the preliminary steps and just lie down, close your eyes, and go straight into omnidirectional hyperspace. Gaze, dissolve, be. Chapter 26. Notice the sensations. Here's something you can try the next time you brush your teeth. Stand at the sink and brush as usual, but close your eyes and notice the tactile sensations of brushing. The shifting pressure and texture of the bristles against your gums, the swishing of toothpaste and water and saliva in your mouth, the darting of your tongue as it dodges the brush. Be as fully aware of these sensations as you can. Be like a scientist who's studying the experience of tactile sensations. To isolate the sensations, consider that if you were a newborn infant, you would have no corresponding visual images of teeth, gums, tongue, brush. You would have no mental concept that these sensations were part of some process for accomplishing some purpose. You would have no memory of having started the process in some now-vanished time, past, and no anticipation of finishing it in some not-yet-arrived time, future. And you certainly wouldn't be lost in planning and speculating about your upcoming day. You would be immersed in pure, simple sensations, unassociated with anything else. Exactly those pure sensations are present now as you brush your teeth. They simply need to be noticed in isolation from the other stuff. The visual images, concepts, memories, and speculations are thoughts, which are there along with the sensations, but distinct from them. Please notice all this as clearly as you can. You're practicing one form of what Adi Shankara and other sages of ancient India called viveka, discrimination, the skill of distinguishing between different experiences that are commonly blurred together, in this case, sensations and thoughts. As simple as it is, this power of discrimination usually goes untapped, and as the sages discovered, it's a surprising key to liberation from fear and everything else that afflicts us. As you continue to brush your teeth with your eyes closed, now notice the sounds of the process, again as pure sensation, in this case auditory sensations, pure hearing, innocent of any association, as an infant would hear them. The tactile sensations persist, but they automatically fade to the background of attention when these auditory sensations move to the foreground. Now, notice the pure sensations of the taste of toothpaste, mixed with saliva and water, independent of the concepts of toothpaste, saliva, or water. Those concepts may be present, but it doesn't matter. They're thoughts, and they're separate. Just taste, like an infant, as if for the first time. And now, still standing at the sink with your eyes closed, notice your emotional tone, such as boredom or excitement, joy or dread. Note that that is also a kind of sensation. It might seem to be clearly located in some part of the body, such as the chest, abdomen, or head, or it might be more generally distributed, but it's a sensation with a subtle but specific texture of its own. We call emotions feelings because they feel certain ways. Joy feels different from depression. As you continue to brush your teeth, the feelings are not the conceptual explanations of why you might feel happy. I hear my kids laughing in the hallway as they get ready for school. Or why you might feel depressed. Gotta go to my stupid job. Those are thoughts. When a thought arises, certainly it's experienced, but that's different from the experience of the feeling or sensation that the thought is about. A thought, we could say, is like the sign outside the zoo that says, zoo. The sign and the zoo are both things, but different things. Discriminate. And now open your eyes and see what's in the mirror. Do you see a face? Actually, no. Seeing purely, as an infant sees, you experience only visual sensations, colors and shapes. Our identification of one region of the colors and shapes as shower curtain and another region as face or my face or me is a thought. The thought is certainly present along with the seeing, but again distinct from it. Also, note that because vision is the dominant default sense for humans, as smelling is for dogs, the moment we open our eyes, all the other senses tend to fade into the background of attention. This is why people close their eyes almost involuntarily to savor music, or a kiss, or an orgasm. Okay, let's take a break. Rinse out your toothbrush and go on to whatever's next. But now that you've done this kind of close looking, you may start to notice that, whether you're taking a shower or making breakfast or driving to work, no matter what you experience, how you experience is the same. There's a rich array of sensations, including those we call feelings, and there are thoughts. They're all in a perpetual dance, arising, changing, vanishing, advancing to the foreground or withdrawing to the background. While driving to work, at any given moment, you might find your attention dominated by the rush of visual sensations as the scenery whips past, or by the auditory sensations of the radio news, the thoughts those sounds convey, and the feelings those thoughts stir up. Suddenly, your attention might go to the sensations of anger when another driver cuts you off, or the sensations of impatience when traffic backs up, or of worry when you're afraid you'll be late to work. You might become so engaged in thoughts about your job that your external senses fade to the background, till a sudden auditory sensation, screech of brakes, triggers an adrenaline-fueled feeling, shit, and a thought, what's going on? Then your job thoughts withdraw. The visual sensations come rushing to the foreground, and you hit your brake, all in a fraction of a second. Sometime later, while you're, say, shopping for groceries, see if you can remember the experience of brushing your teeth. Remember means to reassemble, to put a bunch of members or components back together, as opposed to dismember. But those components, the tactile sensations, the sounds, the sights, the flavors, the feelings and thoughts, are no longer present for assembly. And the present is the only place where we can have an experience. What is available in the present, and therefore experienceable, is a bunch of thoughts about the past experience, which we call memories. We assemble those into a kind of thought model of the original experience, the way we assemble a plastic model of an airplane. Notice, experience, discriminate. So what? Why bother? What does all this noticing and discriminating do for us? First, anything that you focus on with this kind of clarity comes to be experienced more vividly. If you're a musician or a serious music lover, you know that you hear music with a kind of three-dimensional detail that most people miss. If you're an architect or contractor, when you walk into a house, you see the hundreds of large and small design decisions that have been made, the craftsmanship and the hours of work that have shaped the materials into a building. My years of moonlighting as a film critic, and then marrying and learning from a film editor, have made watching great movies extraordinarily rich. The greatest movie symphony skyscraper is life itself, regular, ordinary, mundane, moment-to-moment experience, whether you're paragliding in Oahu or changing tires in Trenton. That's fortunate, because present experience, moment-to-moment life, is the only show in town. If you miss the richness of that show, you've missed the whole thing. Intuitively, everyone knows that, and the terror of missing out on life is what drives people to addiction to intensity, the need for ever crazier parties, ever kinkier porn, louder explosions in each movie sequel, a bigger body count in each video game, a more skull-splitting rush from the next drug. Man, that's a lot of work, and with so much collateral damage. But the more you wake up to the vividness of brushing your teeth, or feeding your baby, or playing your guitar, or tuning your guitar, the more you recognize that this moment, and this one, with whatever's going on in it, is plenty for anyone. No moment is deficient. The 5 loaves and 2 fishes of any given moment turn out to be a banquet. Addiction to intensity, in whatever forms it may have manifested in your life, naturally starts losing its power over you. That doesn't mean your life becomes bland or dull. Quite the opposite. It was our old dullness of perception, our bland, blind oblivion to the silent marvel of a seagull's flight across the sky or a raindrop's course down a window that made us a slave to each new extra shiny object or extra fervid rush. This seeing with an infant's eyes is what Jesus called being like a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven, which he also said is spread upon the earth, mysteriously overlooked by most people. This is being born again, again and again, ever fresh in the ever now. It's a natural result of regular meditation. You may have noticed that sometimes, when you open your eyes at the end of a session, the colors in the room seem somehow deeper, the shadows more delicately nuanced, the sounds from the street more vividly sculpted. And as we go through our day, this kind of attention to sensations that we've just practiced can help put that awakening process into overdrive. If you're lucky enough to have an actual little child around, he or she can remind you how it's done. On the Fearless page at deanwords.com, you can see a photo of my younger grandson, age 14 months, on his first visit to the aquarium, lost in the shimmering, inexplicable miracle before his eyes. And here's a nice touch. He's so thoroughly enraptured that he's oblivious to the hand of mother, always there even when unseen, holding him up so he can be thoroughly enraptured. Part of what keeps our perception fresh is simply discriminating between sensations and thoughts. It's our thoughts that tell us, oh, I know what this is. This is just the tire store in Trenton. Or, this is just the same old walk to work I took yesterday. Or, this is just the same old wife I've been sleeping with for 20 years. Just is a concept, an anti-spice that the mind sprinkles into the soup of reality to make it bland. So is same old. In actual experience, there is only now. If there's only now, there's no old, and there's no same old. Same as what? It's thought that superimposes time onto timeless actuality, and thus creates boredom and staleness and the need for bigger and better rushes. As Ram Dass said, boredom is just lack of attention. It all comes back to Ehi Pasiko, come and see. Go into your kitchen and take one blueberry out of the container, or one orange out of the bowl, or one spoon out of the drawer. See it? Now spend 5 minutes really seeing it. Imagine that after 5 minutes, you'll have to return it to the container with all the other blueberries. We'll mix them up, and then we'll pay you $1,000,000 if you can pick yours out again. Imagine you're an artist who has to paint a gigantic, billboard-sized photorealistic painting of this blueberry. See it now? By simply seeing what's before our eyes, unclouded by the dulling power of abstracting, generalizing thought, we fulfill the prophecy of William Blake. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. Won't be fooled again. This noting has another consequence as well. Although we're savoring things more deeply now, at the same time we're less gripped by them. The gripping quality of experience is a sort of special effect, like the CGI aliens in movies. Through our practice of discrimination, we deconstruct the way we previously smooshed together different components of experience and see how the effect is created. We're no longer fooled. Take, for example, what some people call lust. The very word from the greatest hits list of deadly sins evokes both the fascination and the fear that sexual desire exerts. It's the world's oldest story. Young man sees fine-looking honey, his head spins, and suddenly all he knows is, I must have that woman. It all happens in a second or two, so let's go to slow-mo and break it down. First, there's an experience of visual sensations, shapes, colors, motion. Then the mind interprets them as woman, a thought, and suggests a closer look to scan her characteristics, such as coloring and texture, size, shape, proportions. A few nanoseconds later, it compares the results of the scan to information stored in a database of characteristics that had been filed under attractive or unattractive. Although some of the stored data points reflect personal history, most of it is derived from open-source cultural shareware, which may vary by region and era. See buttock size. If the readout says the woman is attractive, a flood of sensations and physical responses, warm, tingly, bulging, is triggered. There may also be a flood of images of fantasized sexual activities, co-starring the woman and our hero. Those are thoughts. But despite this elaborate process, our young man is too caught up in it, too tightly gripped by it, to have any sense that he's engaged in a process at all. All he knows is if he doesn't penetrate this woman's body with his own, he'll die. He's hooked. Anything that hooks us like that, whether it's drink or drugs or Ben and Jerry's, works by a similar process. Your homework, should you decide to accept it, is to identify whatever craving chronically hooks you, and then, the next time it starts to kick in, observe that craving with the same scientist's eye that we've now brought to lusting and to brushing our teeth. Break down the components. Don't try to suppress the feelings that arise. That usually backfires. Simply observe the whole thing as it happens. Don't try to do anything about any of it. Just see the process, and something starts to shift. You may still feel caught, for now, but you'll notice that you're less tightly caught. The mere act of seeing creates more space around the images and feelings, more freedom to either smoke or not smoke the cigarette, to either eat or not eat the cookie. You can also ask yourself,